Hello, and welcome to The Genomics Life. I am your host, Kelly Moffitt, and my goal is to give you some behind-the-scenes stories of the people, their innovations, and exciting work in the field of genomics. Generally, that's what I want to do. However, today I'm going to do a special episode. Since we are all adjusting to this huge disruption in our lives right now because of an ongoing pandemic, I asked Elodie Geddon if she would be willing to join me to specifically discuss the coronavirus or COVID-19 situation. Elodie is a professor of biology and global public health at NYU, where she uses genomics methods to study microbial pathogens, including human parasites and viruses. She is both a parasitologist and virologist, a MacArthur Fellow, and she has done extensive work with RNA viruses, including influenza and coronaviruses. Thanks for listening, and I hope you find this informative. Hello, and welcome to The Genomics Life. I am here today with Elodie Geddon, and we're having a special episode where instead of going into details of Elodie's life and research in this episode, we are going to talk about a specific topic, which is the current coronavirus situation that we're having. And I would love to come back and do another episode with Elodie later once this situation is resolved and we can do all the interesting things about Elodie's career and life. But for right now, we're going to dive in to the crisis that we're having at hand. And so first, Elodie, could you give us an introduction of who you are and what you do?
Okay. Hi, Kelly. Thanks for inviting me to talk about this. So I'm actually currently a professor of biology at New York University, but I also have a joint appointment in the School of Global Public Health. And so I'm also a professor of epidemiology. And in my research, I actually work on various things, but one of them is specifically on the transmission of respiratory viruses, and more specifically on the transmission of influenza. But in that context, you know, I've been really interested in how these respiratory viruses evolve, and how, in the case of flu, how it emerges. And so right now, this whole pandemic we're having is very relevant to the questions we ask in flu. And they're relevant to what is going on with the emergence of this new respiratory virus.
Yes. And could you tell us a bit about the respiratory virus, which the public is calling coronavirus? Generally, but I guess in the community, we're referring to it as SARS-CoV-2, or we're referring to the disease as COVID-19. Could you go into a little bit about the virus, what type of virus it is, et cetera?
Yes, sure. So, the reason when you're a virologist or when you're trying to be more specific, we say SARS-CoV-2. Because the coronaviruses actually are also responsible for some of our colds that we have every season. So we do actually have human coronavirus. There are actually four or five different strains that we see recurring every season. So when you have the common cold, it can either be a rhinovirus or a coronavirus. And then a few years ago, close to two decades ago, we had the SARS virus that emerged, which is related to the new corona that we see circulating right now. And this was in 2002, 2003. And it was a bit of a similar scenario where the origin of SARS at the time was found to be bats. These are horseshoe bats. And it was thought that what would have been sort of the vector of it was a civet cat, or the civet cats that are being distributed in some wet markets in China. So it's a bit the same scenario that we're seeing now, where the origin of the current SARS-CoV, that's why it's called COVID-2, it's because the original SARS is called SARS-CoV. And we can trace back its origin by looking at the genetic material, the genetic information, trace it back to its closest related species is in bats currently.
And then we also had MERS, which was.
Yep, so MERS is a different coronavirus. This one is a little bit more distant, it's different, but we suspect that its origin may have been bats also, but this time the what would be the vector or the intermediate to humans were camels. And so again, you know what, for virologists that look at emerging infections or emerging viruses, we often think, you know, we should be looking in hot zones, and parts of the world are considered hot zones of emergence, where you have high diversity of mammals, small mammals, high density of human population, where you have encroaching of human into animal populations through deforestation or just, you know, urban sprawl. So having emerging viruses from, you know, China, parts of China, is not all that surprising. What was surprising is when MERS emerged, because it wasn't at all in what we consider a hot zone. It's not, you know, from a high density area. It wasn't where you have high diversity, you know, like forests and all that. So that was more surprising. This current SARS-CoV-2 is not all that surprising. We did suspect that eventually we would have another emerging virus like that.
How similar are SARS-CoV and SARS-CoV-2?
Yeah, so I wanted to look at the genomes. I can't give you a percentage. They're relatively similar, where we can sort of put them in the same category. Like, we know they all come from bats, but they're not super, super close.
So this one is closer to bat coronaviruses than it is
Correct.
to
Yes. Yeah.
SARS-CoV.
That's right. If
I'm
you
sorry
put
to
it
say
in,
that.
when you look at it in the phylogenetic tree, there was a bat virus from a couple of years ago, where it really clusters with that on the tree. You see it. It's much closer to that bat COVID than to the SARS. But it's more distant to what we call the human coronaviruses, basically.
Great. So that's very informative, and this explains why we know that this is a new for from the general immersion that happened at the end of December, early January, that this was a new coronavirus that we had not yet seen before in humans.
Correct.
And what type of virus is this? I know what it is, but for our audience, like RNA, and is
So
there any?
it's a plus strand, single strand RNA virus genome. And so flu is negative strand, and this is plus strand. So that means that even if you extract the RNA itself is considered partly infectious. Now, you would need to have, you know, a lot of it, so that, you know, when we talk about disinfecting an area, if you use only ethanol, for example, or some type of alcohol, you're only breaking the surface. It's an envelope virus, so it has a lipid layer. You're just breaking the surface, but basically the genome remains intact. So in theory, the genome is still infectious.
Oh, I did not understand that.
Yep.
So in other words, even though you've used ethanol to break down that lipid layer, how would it still, the lipid layer is just kind of protecting that RNA.
Right. So in theory, if that RNA, so the RNA is it's like a messenger RNA. So all it needs is some kind of polymerase. And so if it encounters a polymerase that is able to basically translate that that messenger RNA, it could make some of the proteins and then, you know, wow, reconstruct a virus. But this is really pushing it. I mean, uh-huh, when you work in a lab setting where you extract from, you know, an infected individual, you collect a sample, you extract the RNA, that RNA, you're supposed to treat it as if it's still infectious. So you would do it, you know, under BSL-2 plus conditions. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when we're talking about cleaning surfaces and, you know, washing our hands, it's highly unlikely that even if you only break the lipid layer, that that RNA would basically be infectious.
Okay. Got it. Okay, and now from your perspective as a virologist, how important is it to understand the origins of the outbreak, not just what you were saying in terms of watching emerging viruses in areas where you expect to maybe see them or not see them, but in terms of now looking back at how it started and how generally they thought it came from the Wuhan seafood market, and then now they're saying, I saw that there is a case that was definitely outside of Wuhan. Is that important to look at right now? Or
so that,
yeah, sorry, go
ahead. Sorry, but that case you mentioned, so is it outside of where they think it's earlier than the Wuhan market?
They say that that the person was not in Wuhan. It was in the outside of there. I don't know. I think it's in New England Journal of Medicine today or recently.
Oh, I missed it.
But it, I know you can keep
track.
Up.
I know.
I don't know. I don't know more than that. I just saw the little blurb. I didn't read the whole thing. But is that important to decision making right now? Or are we in a decision making, like what in your job right now is the most important? Is it more history of the outbreak or is it more, what do we do right now?
Yes. Yeah, so right now it's really, what do we do? And mm-hmm, I think there's still important remaining questions, right? Mm-hmm. So the history is really important and I'll go into that in a minute. But if we look at what's happening right now, we still have the following questions. So A, it's still, do asymptomatics transmit as much as people who have, you know, clearly symptoms and aren't coughing? Okay, so it seems like a very simple question. And in many respiratory viruses, it's usually, you know, when you're coughing, sneezing, that you're more, you're probably transmitting more. But here, it's not clear that it's the case because there's no sneezing with this current coronavirus. It's more this dry cough, and we still don't understand how well it's transmitted with asymptomatics. So right now, you know, unfortunately, here in the US, we're only sampling or testing individuals that have clear symptoms that really fit, you know, what is now considered our textbook symptoms, which would be, you know, the dry cough, high fever, you know, the general malaise that we associate with something that's like flu-like. And also there's a GI tract, you know, diarrhea, not feeling well at all. But even there, if you have all these symptoms, you may not even get a test. And we're still at the level where it's only if you've interacted with someone who has been diagnosed with COVID-19 that you're automatically getting tested. But this changes every day. So it's very possible that by Friday, we'll be testing everyone who has flu-like symptoms. We just, you know, we're not there yet. But ideally, from an epidemiology standpoint and from a genomics, you know, molecular genomics standpoint, ideally we want to test as many people as possible and collect samples from all these individuals. So, you know, first testing, if you have no symptoms, you know, what is the prevalence of SARS-CoV in individuals that have no symptoms? Even if you just look at that subgroup, we don't know what the answer is to that yet. Eventually we will, but we're not there yet.
Mm-hmm.
And then even in people who are, let's say, mild disease versus severe, like extremely severe disease, is the virus the same in both? We assume it is, but there was a paper that came out last week saying that there were two lineages of COVID that were co-circulating or had been co-circulating. They called it the L and the S. Now, the paper was based on a very limited set of samples, and it had, I think it was something like 25 samples from Wuhan, and then it had, peppered samples from Europe and from different places. It was a very small set, and they had seen that what they call the L lineage, they call it a type. So the L type was predominant in Wuhan, with the S being minor, but in Europe it was the opposite. It was the S that was major and the L was minor. And their conclusion, based on zero statistics, was that the L was milder, but the S was more aggressive. Or I think, or it may have been the opposite, but either way, it just the conclusions were completely not based on strong data. There just wasn't power to be able to say that one or the other was more what they called aggressive, which I assume they meant that transmitted more and could lead to more disease. But so I think it was just, from an observation standpoint, yes, it's interesting to see, lineages, and then to see, where do we find certain lineages versus others. Lineages are based on just a few point mutations that are occurring in this large, it's a relatively large genome for an RNA virus. In fact, the coronaviruses have the largest RNA genomes because it's difficult for an RNA molecule to be very large, and especially if you have no proofreading. Now, the coronaviruses have some proofreading, so it has a mutation rate that maybe it's a little similar to flu, but it does other things. It does recombination and all that contributes to diversity. So the genome is 30,000 bases compared to influenza, that is, something like 11, 10, between 10 and 11,000 bases.
Yeah, significantly larger.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then when you look at the phylogeny, they're talking about three clades from what I can tell, and that's kind of also based on one that is strongly from China, and then
Correct.
one that's strongly European, and one that's kind of Asia but not China plus European. And I guess there were, is that meaningful to you right now, or it's just kind of observing
Yeah, so
where
right
it helps
now
with
it's,
tracing?
yeah, exactly. So right now it's more for the tracing. And we do that in flu too, where you look at clades and you see how you get co-mingling. And so in certain areas of the world, so for example, in China, you would expect it to be relatively homogeneous, because you would have, first there's the founder effect, and then you don't have right now much traveling globally that, in and out of China. But then you would expect, so parts of Europe, you would find also specific clades in like Italy. But then in a city like New York, I suspect that as we start sequencing more samples from New York and from cities where you have a lot of, where you have had in the last 2 months, a lot of traveling in and out, that we're going to find multiple clades. I really doubt we'll find a New York clade.
And then, can you talk a little about R0, which a lot of people are constantly talking about, and I
Yes.
don't really have a grasp on if it's meaningful right now or if it's something
Right.
you can only look at later?
So the R0 is that reproductive number. So basically, it's an indicator of how many other people, if you're infected, how many other people you can infect. And so it gives you a measure of how transmissible the virus is also. So if we take the example, we'll take two examples. We'll take flu because it's a respiratory virus also. So flus are not is about 1.3. So it's between 1 and 2. And so that means that each person with flu can infect 1 to 2 other individuals. Now, if you infect two individuals, you can imagine that assuming a population completely susceptible with no limits, you would have an exponential growth, even with just an R naught of 2. That means, I infect two people, these two people infect two others, et cetera, until, the whole population gets infected. And that's what happens in a susceptible population. Now, the extreme case is measles. So measles has an R naught that's, sometimes I've heard it was 13, sometimes 18, sometimes 15. It's measles is actually the most infectious agent ever. And so that's why not vaccinating your child is criminal. Because some people cannot get vaccinated, and it can be a death sentence for babies
That
and
is where you get
children.
true herd immunity.
Exactly. So when people are vaccinated, they provide like a wall of protection to the ones who are not vaccinated. So then if we go back to this coronavirus against which we have no protection because we're all susceptible, the R naught was estimated to be between 2 and 3. Okay, but so it's higher than flu. It's far more transmittable than flu. And just having 2 to 3 is actually a big. It still will cause havoc because this exponential growth becomes even larger here. But we have to remember that the R naught or this reproductive number is not a static number. So if you have a portion of the population that now becomes immune because, or at least immune to the currently circulating strain, you are providing a bit of protection so that you will slow down the transmission. So the more individuals have been infected and are recovering, the slower now the infection will be, and this transmission will be. So that's, what you would expect. And that's why we do containment. So if you do containment, you're basically letting an infection infect everybody within the area of containment. But then it can die off because it has no more susceptible hosts. So that's why we do it. So the same thing with social distancing. The reason we do social distancing and why it's so important is that you're limiting the number of individuals that you can pass it on to. And again, you can reduce that reproductive rate, that reproductive number. So that's why all this is really important. It doesn't mean that eventually some people won't get it, but what we're trying to do is slow down the transmission so that it could basically allow, the healthcare system to support people who are really, really sick.
Yes, absolutely. Okay, this is great. This is very, very informative. So at this point, are you happy with what's going on, at least in the US, in terms of the measures that are being taken finally to try to prevent the spread?
Oh, sadly, I mean, happy, I don't think is the right word. I'm relieved that we are now taking it a little bit more seriously. But I'm in New York, and I have to say it was a little disturbing to see how people were reacting, yesterday and over the weekend. And I have to say myself, a week ago, I wasn't thinking of this as much as I see now, I'm more informed than most people in the population. And I still was, okay, we need to limit our contacts. But even there, it's really hard to apply when, you don't see it.
Right.
are not just sick instantaneously. There's
Yes,
such a long
exactly.
incubation period.
Yes.
But this weekend, it was just to see how nonchalant people were. I was walking on the street, and there were a bunch of young people walking together, and I was trying to keep my distances, but I could hear them talking. And they were saying, "Oh, I don't know about this whole social distancing." And one was saying, "Oh, it's not illegal yet to be,
Yet.
close together, and who cares? It's all crap anyway." So nobody really believed it. And I think the problem is because we didn't really have it taken seriously at the top.
Right.
And so we're a little we're 2 months late,
We're very behind. We could have been testing
very
this whole
behind.
time. And for
Yeah,
me
yeah.
personally, it didn't hit me until maybe a week and a half ago that we hadn't been testing. I
Yes,
didn't
yeah.
realize that the CDC's primers were not working as expected, and that that whole thing had happened, and that there was just, we missed the whole window of opportunity to be testing everyone who asked to be tested. And
Yeah, yeah.
now we're, it's just way too late. It's, and going into that, do you have any
Yes.
thoughts on the testing situation?
Yes. Yeah, I
Yeah.
do have thoughts.
Great.
I have thought about this a lot. So, we keep on hearing about the CDC, and basically they've become the scapegoat.
Okay.
So the CDC is not to blame. I'll tell you why. Because it is the process that the CDC, who are, an amazing institution, and the scientists there are fantastic. And there is a process where they basically develop a lot of these assays that are distributed worldwide. Now, the CDC has been gutted a bit. And also the fact that there's, it happens that there are problems with reagents. And when you're trying
Of
to
course.
deploy something very quickly, you don't have time to basically validate things as well as they should be. And I'm sure they did a lot of validation, but it ended up, that I think it was their negative control. There was a problem with it. So what happens is when you do a diagnostic test and you want to have a positive control to confirm you're positive, but you also want to have a negative control so that if your negative looks positive, there's a problem with your whole assay. And so that was there was an issue, I think, with the reagents for the negative control. Now, in cases of emergencies, which is what this whole epidemic, now pandemic, has been, there are workarounds where, there were tests that worked in Germany. They developed a test that worked really well, and that was adopted by WHO. And so my understanding is that there was, the WHO reaching, saying, the US should be using these tests, but they weren't taken up on it. And so there were very strict rules, and there are often, there have to be strict rules for diagnosis.
Yes,
And then the FDA has, these very strict rules, because you don't want just anybody, making a test and saying, "Oh, it's positive," because you don't want to have false positives, just like you
right.
don't want to have false negatives.
Yes.
But in cases of emergency, you have to find a compromise where you deal with labs that are reputable, companies that are reputable, that could do these tests
Right.
in different ways. Now, one of the limitations also is that the whole procedure for the diagnostic test was to use one specific machine using one specific set of reagents, and then also to do extraction of the RNA using another specific reagent. So what's happening right now is that there weren't enough of these specific machines, so the company that produces them had to manufacture more. Then there weren't enough of the reagents that go with that machine. And then there are not, right now, there's a big shortage of a specific extraction kit for RNA. When, if you've worked with RNA, any scientist who's worked with RNA, you can use anything. You can use phenochloroform to extract RNA, and it will still be high quality. So there's no reason we should be using specific kits for extraction of RNA. Do you see what I'm saying?
I absolutely do.
Yeah. So there's been all these very rigid limitations that have been imposed that could have been relieved by, someone at the top
At the
says,
top,
hey
yeah.
guys, this is, this is an emergency.
Yes.
Let's all work on this. So we've seen, last week at the end of the week, we did see that finally all these companies have been brought together and finally we're finding, new ways around these very, very difficult rules that have been imposed. And by the way, they were not, these are not rules that were imposed years ago and that nobody could get around. There's the whoever is at the
Reset.
top can, yeah, whoever is at the top can decide to remake those rules,
Right,
and
understood.
yeah, and it wasn't done because people at the top did not think this was that important, didn't want to panic people, and there's nothing worse than not being transparent and not
Yep.
communicating what is going on, and that's why
And that's where we are.
we are where we are, and
Exactly.
it's incredibly embarrassing that the US should be in this position right now.
Yeah, it's
Besides
kind of
being
devastating.
criminal,
Yeah.
that there are people who will die because of this.
There are so many people. It's heartbreaking. And when you just look back the time that we've had to prepare and
And we didn't prepare. We did not
instead we
prepare.
tried to just suppress and that it's
And
not
when you
working.
see, no, exactly. And when you see what's going on in Italy right now, where the healthcare system is starting to be
Overwhelmed.
overwhelmed and they have to make really, really difficult, choices on who lives, who dies. And I suspect we will be here in a week.
Yeah, that's my thought too. So it's very depressing and difficult to handle. What can we do right now? Is there any? I know a lot of universities are coming together. I know Hopkins, for example, has shut down their lab operations that are not related or essential. Is this what we're looking for everyone to do? Is there anything that us in the genomics community can do, et cetera?
So I think the genomics community has come together, and all these labs that, that have capability have
Yes.
been basically, especially in med schools, because they're set up to do a lot of this at BSL-3, which is how, samples need to be initially processed. And there have been, I know the Seattle group, they've done extraordinary work. And so there are multiple groups around the US who are rallying and trying to put data out also as soon as they're sequencing any genome, putting it out in real time, which is
Yes,
important
I've
to
been watching that.
inform. Yeah, no, it's pretty awesome.
It's
That
amazing.
website, Nextstrain,
Yes,
that
Nextstrain. Yep.
Trevor Bedford.
Yes, he's amazing. I follow everything he says on Twitter.
No, he's been
He's
wonderful. And
amazing.
that site has been great even for flu. A lot of us have been using
You're
that
very,
site, for a
yes,
long time. And so that's great. And everybody, he's like so open, and everybody has been basically interacting with him. And so I think the universities have, I know, at NYU, we're not in the med school, but at NYU here, we also, the labs are all shut down, but there is for emergencies, they do allow us to, help us with purchasing for primers because we're going to be sequencing some of the viruses right now. And the med school, they're doing a lot of work. Mount Sinai also is doing a lot of work on that. And so I think there are people who are working all together. And then, one thought is that I am so happy Anthony Fauci is who he is because
Yeah.
he has been the voice of reason. Besides being a brilliant man, he's an excellent communicator. And it's been really reassuring to have him talk about all this and explain. I think people are taking him seriously.
Yes.
So
Yes.
that's been important.
Navigating that situation for him must be so trying.
Oh, it must be. He's a saint because
Yeah.
he's when he has to listen to the things we hear, and he's staying classy. Amazing.
Yeah, it is amazing. And then, do you have any quick thoughts on using DNA sequencing for detection eventually rather than just PCR? Like, is there an advantage there, especially with prices coming down, with direct RNA sequencing, with
Yeah,
nanopore, et
yeah,
cetera?
yeah, yeah. So eventually, I think it will, this will happen eventually. I know my own lab, we work with a group at Penn State University that it's a material physicists, a biomedical engineer, and they've developed a platform for enrichment of virus particles. And so we're trying to develop it actually as a very quick assay. And we've talked with Oxford Nanopore to see, whether we would have enough, enriched particles to then do a quick RNA extraction and then run directly on the nanopore. So that's what we're hoping to do eventually. But all of this is still, all at the testing phase. And so the PCR right now is the best way to go for quick response and sensitivity of the assay also, because you don't need that you don't need to have a very high viral titer to get a positive or to get a clean response.
Okay. And then do you have any comments on any of the possible hope for maybe getting some sort of treatment, any of the
Yes.
drugs that are out there right now that I'm
Yeah.
hearing about?
Yeah. There is one drug that seems to be doing relatively well that's being developed by Gilead. It's remdesivir. And so that seems to work. And I think they're doing a lot of tests. It's just not, not on the market yet. I think they still have a lot of tests they need to do. There were a bunch of other types of
And for that one that you were just talking about, I don't know how to pronounce it, remdesivir.
remdesivir. Yeah, I don't even know if I'm pronouncing it correctly, but it's remdesivir. It's developed. It's
that one is that I believe that's the one where it incorporates a terminator base rather than as a substitution for like it disrupts the ability for the RNA to be
That's right.
copied, right?
Yeah,
And
the RNA polymerase,
right.
it inhibits the RNA polymerase.
So
Yeah,
that
yeah.
sounds really promising because you could see how if they've used that for, I think it was Ebola and MERS maybe,
That's
that they
right.
didn't get very far necessarily, but they know that they've already tested it on humans and humans tend to
Correct.
do okay on it.
Yeah,
My
yeah.
thought though was I think it has to be used pretty early. Maybe not early, but like if a patient is like in, having pneumonia,
Exactly, it's
that
too
may not
late.
help,
Yeah,
but this again brings up we have to have testing so that people have options if there are if they get this through clinical trials and it's available. Hopefully the testing will catch up by then.
well, exactly. So that's yeah, I mean you explained it very clearly here, is that these antivirals, they are good early on, because once the damage is done, the damage is done, especially here with the lungs and the pneumonia. It basically destroys your lungs, and there's no getting that back right away. So you can basically die of suffocation. But so that's why, if you could give the antiviral drug when you're positive but showing very little symptoms, that would be ideal. Yeah, and that drug is showed to prove to be pretty effective against SARS and MERS when they did it in vitro. So of course, it needs more testing. That's why they're testing it. And there were, they started testing also different, like protease inhibitors, which would seem weird. They're used usually for HIV, but that's because there's an essential component of the SARS. And when it replicates, there's a protease that is essential for,
I see.
I can't think of the word, but anyway, and that it prevents it inhibits that protease. So there are other, types of drugs that are being developed. So, ideally, you want one that is very specific for this SARS-CoV-2, but we'll see if we get there. And then, of course, the vaccine will take, that would be ideal because then you are protecting part of your population, just like we do with flu. But that will take a little while. There are some candidates that are being developed and it's being fast-tracked, but there's, even when you fast-track, there's still a big limitation because you can imagine that you don't, in animals, you vaccinate and then you challenge with an infection, but you can't do that with a human, right? So you have to wait until somebody gets naturally infected and then do high enough numbers of individuals in a population so that then you have the statistics to say, half my population was vaccinated. And then during an epidemic, the people who are vaccinated have a far lower prevalence of infection than the unvaccinated half of my population. So those take time.
Yeah, that'll be a while.
Yeah.
The only hope right now is that maybe there's a drug that can help, and it can somehow be rolled out, and there can be
Correct.
enough for people to actually use, and all these things have to come together. Do you have any final comments or anything else to say about
No,
the
besides, I'm just hoping people will take this seriously. And then I just read today, we keep on saying that the average age of people who have died is 80. And then we say people who are above 60 are at risk. And now we're seeing more and more cases of much younger individuals who are dying. So now we don't know. So people need to take this seriously.
There's lots of unknowns,
Yep,
and
exactly.
everyone needs to do their part.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, well, thank you so much for doing this podcast with me, and thank you for all of your insights. I really appreciate it.
Great. Thank you very much, Kelly.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to reach out. My email address is thegenomicslife@gmail.com.